I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN. What is it that makes us, as humans, different, even, shall I say, better than monkeys? Maybe not much these days, but we do have a few things going for us as a species. But I mean, if Charlie Darwin is right, we all started in the same tree, so how did we end up so different from our pesky primate cousins? Well, I like to think it's our ability to think and create and build the world around us. I like to believe it's the arts and sciences that make us different and, yes, better than monkeys. Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN Radio. Music hath charms to soothe the savage breast, to soften rocks and bend a knotted oak. William Congreve penned those words in his 1697 poem, The Mourning Bride, and I couldn't agree more. Almost every one of us turns to music in times of joy, sorrow, longing, and celebration. And speaking of celebration, world-renowned harpist Yolanda Condonassis celebrates American composers on a wonderful new CD titled American Rapture, featuring Jennifer Higdon's harp concerto. Joining her in the recording are Ward Stair and the Rochester Philharmonic. It's a wonderful recording, and at the time of this podcast recording, she's been nominated for another Grammy Award for her performance and recording of the Higdon Harp Concerto in the category of Best Classical Instrumental Solo. She's widely considered one of the world's premier solo harpists, and she's undoubtedly one of the most recorded, with about 22 CDs in her catalog. She's also an author, an educator, and an environmental champion, a true Renaissance woman, and our guest on this episode of Better Than Monkeys, Yolanda Condonassis. Your big debut was when you were just 18 years old, I read, with Zubin Mehta and the New York Philharmonic.
Right.
Now, it would be intimidating for any musician, if had they been soloing for 50 years, to have to perform with Zubin Mehta and the New York Philharmonic, but you were just 18. What led to that first performance with the New York Phil, and how did you pull it off without an incredibly huge sense of nerves?
Well, you know, that does now seem like quite some time ago, and I have a daughter who's about the same age I was when I did that. So that kind of, you know, that sort of reference point is an interesting one when you sort of look back on your career and your life and your perspectives at various times. And I had gone to the Interlochen Arts Academy up in Michigan for 4 years of my high school. So really, I often say that experience was a lot like college, but at the high school level, because it's right. A boarding school. You know, you're responsible for getting yourself up in the morning and doing your laundry and managing your money and, you know, taking care of your business. So I think that experience sort of put me on a bit of an accelerated track to just kind of managing myself. So I think that in terms of being ready for that and keeping yourself together, relatively speaking, in an experience like that was helped a lot by my training and my high school experience. But, you know, there's no way around it. You're nervous when you do something like that. And it was memorable on a lot of fronts because, well, first of all, there was just the New York element. And I had for years, I was a big reader, and I had read probably, you know, 600 books that took place in New York City back when we read books.
Right.
it was the first time I'd ever gone to New York. I grew up in Norman, Oklahoma, and then, as I said, went to high school in Michigan. So that in of itself, going to New York City for the competition, it was actually the result of a competition that the New York Philharmonic, I'm not sure if they still hold it or not, but it was a national competition open to young instrumentalists, and going there for the, I think it was kind of a good thing that for the competition, it was the first time I'd ever been in New York, so I had a lot of distractions, and I was just wowed and just, you know, overwhelmed by the place itself. So the audition was almost secondary to the newness and the experience of going to New York for the first time. And I remember the day of that competition, I had, the year before, I had won something which at the time was called the Arts Recognition and Talent Search Competition, and it took place in, down in Miami. Now it's called, it's morphed into something called Young Arts, and it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. But, so I had won that the year before, and they had invited me to come down and do a concert in Miami as sort of a result of various things that, you know, that win had produced. And my audition in New York was the morning of that concert in Miami. So I had, it was sort of the beginning of a lifetime of trying to be two places at once, which is sort of my MO. I'm going to be doing that in a couple of weeks again, thinking, God, you know, I just have not learned that I'm only one person. But so I did that audition for the New York Phil. And then immediately I hustled to the airport and got down to Miami, and it was all very, you know, rigorous day of changing clothes and taxi cabs and, you know, doing all sorts of stuff. And I remember I got the call. I had given the New York Phil the number of the place where I was going to be that night, and they called, and there happened to be, it was a big event, and they had a live band at the event down in Miami, and I got the call, and I told the presenter, and I'll never forget, a few minutes later, the band broke out into a very raucous rendition of New York, New York, and I don't know, just, you know, as an 18-year-old, it was really a special kind of new experience of a career launch, in a way. You know, it felt very hopeful and very exciting and very sparkly, and you know, it's just a great memory. And so doing the concerts felt a lot more like a reward than, you know, a stress bath, I guess I would say.
Right. And for some reason, I keep picturing the opening credits of Mary Tyler Moore, the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
when
she gets to
the
big city and
she
throws her hat. That could have been your first approach to New York. Well, what an exciting way to kick off your career in grand fashion with Zubin Mehta and the New York Philharmonic. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other wonderful things you've done as we go. But, you know, you were talking about having to go from New York to Miami to perform, and it's you move around so much. The harp is hardly a tiny instrument. How do you pack and cart that thing and get from gig to gig so quickly when it's such a delicate instrument? Or do you borrow them when you get to other orchestras?
Well, you know, I do a combination of both things. When I was just starting out, of course, I was extremely conscientious, and for most things, I wanted my own instrument. So when I was, you know, probably in my 20s, I must have zigzagged the entire country at least 2-3 times a year. And it was a very, I remember that very fondly, too, because I love that feeling of just me in the open road and that sense of adventure. So I didn't mind it at all. But now, because things are so busy, I'd say in the last, you know, couple of decades, I more often than not will use a harp where I'm going, because there just isn't the cushion time on either end to drive places. I still do it once in a while. If it's on the East Coast, generally the hassle of flying is more work than just hopping in the car and, you know, driving to New York or Boston or Philly or Chicago or something
right
nearby. But I do use a whole bunch of different harps every year. But the good thing is I've been doing this a while, so in just about every city I might go to at this point, I know someone, and in many cases know the harp. So I know what I'm getting. There isn't that sense of the unknown and, you know, gosh, is this harp going to be in pieces when I arrive? But I
right
do tend
the
to
fear, yeah,
do a bit of work on whatever harps I use. You know, I try to get places at least a half a day to a day early so that I can make any little mechanical tweaks that I need to before I use it.
See, that's really nice that you know how to do that, too. You know, pianists touring the country, they don't have that luxury. They just walk into a hall and there's your instrument. Good luck. Go get them.
Well, yeah. I think that piano technicians are a lot more plentiful than harp technicians.
Oh, I'm sure.
And very early on, actually, in fairness, harp technicians are getting much more plentiful. There's a wonderful network of harp regulators throughout the country. And, you know, like, for instance, I did a recent concert this summer at Grant Park in Chicago with the Grant Park Orchestra. And Lyon and Healy Harps, huge harp factory, which is based in Chicago. I didn't even know it, and they sent a technician to just be standing there, you know, standing by. And, you know, so that is a once-in-a-while luxury, but I was kind of trained up to be able to fix my own harp, barring anything really big, like a, you know, break in the linkage or something like that. That's a factory repair. But I find it a lot more comforting to be able to do that kind of thing myself instead of depending on others. And I also have specific priorities. You know, I will compromise on one little thing so that I can have a really, you know, a string with some integrity. Because a lot of times one will sacrifice sound quality for pitch, and if it's, for instance, in an E sharp position, which isn't used that much, I will sacrifice a tiny bit of pitch in that position for sound quality in the other two positions, which are used a lot. I know that's very highly technical, but you know, it's a personal thing that makes it so that I kind of like fixing my own harp.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN Radio. I'm Brian Hanna, and today's guest, harpist Yolanda Condonassis. Now, how did you get into harp, though? So, say you go to a petting zoo when you're 5 or 6, you know, you're going to look at a violin and a cello, maybe even a trumpet or a trombone or an oboe or something, and you picked the harp. How'd that happen?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a weird story, I guess. When I was probably about 7 or 8, we took a family trip to Chicago on Valentine's Day weekend, and my mother was a pianist and a piano teacher, so a definite necessity on the trip was to go visit the big, giant, like, music department store, which was then called Lyon & Healy. Now Lyon & Healy specializes only in harps, oddly enough, but at the time, it was just a big, very impressive, multi-floor music store. And I guess because it was Valentine's Day, they had a huge display on the storefront of every size and variety of harps, with cherubs and hearts and, you know, that whole thing. And we were both my mom and I were very fascinated by that. But I think it really kind of captured my mom's imagination a lot. And, you know, at that age, 7, 8 years old, I was probably a little bit more interested in the, you know, the caramel corn guy on the corner than the harps in the window. But I was also a bit of a, as I mentioned, I grew up in Norman, Oklahoma, and I had played the piano since earliest memory, and that was really my passion, my instrument. But I think my mom was looking for me to take up another instrument, and I think she thought it would be kind of a double benefit to do something like the harp and hope that it would refine me a little bit, because I was developing, I guess, into a bit of a tomboy, and she thought maybe it would get me into a dress and teach me some of the finer things of life. And so, lo and behold, a few weeks later, a small harp arrived at our door that she had ordered, and I started lessons. And because I'd had so much piano training, it came very quickly. I kept the piano and the harp going through about halfway through Interlochen Arts Academy, and then I finally sort of needed to fish or cut bait with one of them. And I love the harp. I love the way it feels. I love the way it sounds. But I think I made the decision between the piano and the harp from a slightly practical standpoint, in that I felt like the piano had an awful lot of advocates, had an awful lot of ambassadors, and that perhaps what I'd learned about the harp by then, by the time I was about 16, was that the harp really needed more ambassadors. And I also, about that same time, discovered the Ginastera harp concerto, which, you know, given my personality, I love the repertoire of the harp, the French, the very liquid, the romantic repertoire. But I think discovering the Ginastera harp concerto really suited my personality, and I said to myself, you know, with rep like this, I can do something with this instrument. So, you know, it was a little bit prophetic in terms of the kind of music that I've chosen to play and promote and commission. And, you know, it was I think in the end it was a really good decision.
Well, that's a good lead into another topic there. You know, the Ginastera's part of the standard harp repertoire, but you're doing everything you can to expand that harp repertoire. You do champion modern music. You work with Bright Sheng and Hannah Lash and Jennifer Higdon, among others. Why is new music for the harp so important when there is so much great music for the harp already out there? Or isn't there that much music for the harp already out there?
Well, you know what? Actually, there is an awful lot of music for the harp out there, but I find that a lot of the music falls into kind of two categories. One is that very traditional, gorgeous, liquid, what everybody thinks of the harp repertoire, and I do not snub my nose at that whatsoever. I've recorded a huge amount of it. I believe in it, and when I program recitals, I try and, you know, include some of that, because you don't want to just knock somebody over the head with music and say, here's what you should be liking. But I feel that the other category of music for the harp that is in abundance is a lot of new music, but that is not either terribly idiomatic or it just kind of sits on the shelf. And so what I have tried to do, especially in the last 10, 15 years of my career, has been to both commission new works and try and, as best I can, make them as idiomatic as possible through collaboration with the composers and, you know, help some of the music that's sitting on the shelf see the light of day. I did an album a few years ago called American Harp, and there was a lot of music on there that just doesn't get played very often by composers we know, you know, Stephen Paulus, Elliot Carter, Lowell Lieberman. Actually, it was a very new piece that I discovered just a couple of months before I recorded the album and said, oh my gosh, I got to put this on there. But, you know, so I guess my career would at this point be largely devoted to both commissioning and kind of shepherding music that already exists and just doesn't get played out into the open. And I just wrote a book called The Composer's Guide to Writing Well for the Modern Harp, and that is kind of part and parcel with that mission of trying to make music more idiomatic for the harp.
Well, that was going to be my next question, actually.
I mean, it's a big part of it.
They're so unfamiliar with it because it's such an unfamiliar instrument. I would assume that most composers use it incidentally as a fill instrument. So writing solo works for the harp probably take a lot of collaboration with a harpist to actually train a composer how to write for that instrument.
Yeah, and you know, it's a fine line. I mean, I've worked with some wonderful composers, and the fine line is you don't want to sit there and, like, you know, tell a highly esteemed composer how to write. You don't want to in any way approach it in a way that is disrespectful. Mm-hmm. However, I feel like by writing this book, it's a resource that they can have on their table, you know, at 2 a.m. And if they think, gosh, you know, is that reach on the harp possible? You know, to have a source for questions and easy, user-friendly reference, I think, was a very important thing. It also has a huge catalog of special effects, and I tried to, in some cases, invent symbols that will hopefully standardize some of the indications for certain special effects on the harp, because it's a weird thing on the harp. There are many, many symbols that mean the same, that mean different things.
Right.
And then there are many things, like many different effects on the harp that have 3 or 4 different symbols to indicate them. So I guess a submission with the book was to at least hope to standardize some of these symbols and make it so that, you know, you don't spend half an hour for every symbol you see in a new piece of music thinking, okay, now which thing does this symbol indicate, you know? You know, there are a lot of submissions in this book, and it's out on Carl Fisher, which hopefully will make it very readily available to anybody who's interested in having it.
Well, you also, you're not just a performer, you teach. You teach at Oberlin and CIM, Cleveland Institute of Music. So has your book made it into the composition classes there already?
Well, I hope so. It's just out a couple of months. So I know at CIM, the composer who teaches at CIM, Keith Fitch, is a good friend, and I believe he has introduced it to the composition department there. But hopefully, you know, it'll make its way around and be of some use, I hope.
Well, that's not the only book you've written. I guess you've written any number of books, including a children's book called Our House is Round. And that can lead to a couple more topics here, because Our House is Round is a book about protecting the earth, which is another of your passions besides music. You want to tell us a little bit about that book and a little bit about your desire to work to protect the environment?
Well, yeah, you know, I guess I have sort of a multitasking personality, but I really feel like, you know, you spend decades getting so that you play an instrument well. I mean, it's a really, it's an elaborate task for anyone to really master an instrument. And once you do that, you sort of think, you know, how can one make as good a use of that time and accumulated knowledge as possible. And, you know, of course, as you said, the teaching is a part of that as well. But I think that when you have something you can offer in the way of performed music, recorded music, I think sometimes it's important to try and figure out a way to advocate for perhaps even a larger mission, if you can. And I've been interested in earth conservation and environmental causes for, oh gosh, at least 20 years now. And I think it kind of started with a project that I did with Telarc. The album was music of Alan Hovhaannis, who is a great composer who took an awful lot of inspiration from natural phenomenon, natural scenarios. He kind of almost glorified the beauty of the earth in a lot of his music, and I think that sort of sparked an interest in me to perhaps try and relate music to the earth in a way that perhaps would spark some action, some awareness of what is going on with our environment. And so I started a nonprofit organization called Earth at Heart that has the mission of inspiring earth conservation and literacy and awareness through the portal of the arts, because I think that, you know, it's one thing to hand somebody an article and say, gosh, you know, read about this. It's really, you know, enlightening or very alarming or whatever. And it's another thing entirely to let someone experience a piece of art or a piece of music that is geared to evoking something that's going on environmentally or otherwise. And so I guess it's hoping that in creating works of art that might illuminate some of these issues, it takes a little bit of a different portal into the brain, and perhaps will inspire, if nothing more than awareness, and you know, even better, some action.
What age range does your book appeal to?
Well, the book was a project, kind of one of the first projects of Earth at Heart, and the book appeals to the ages of, I'd say, about 6 to 11, I would imagine, would be the target range. And that came to be just because my daughter was in that age range when I decided to do it. And she went to a wonderful school where they were doing all sorts of projects about recycling and whatnot. And I was the perpetual room mom, and so I got to know a lot of her friends, and I would just sort of, you know, ask casual questions when I was around them. It's like, so, you know, do you know why it's so important to recycle? And most of these kids, they didn't. They said, well, you know, because it you know, they'd say things like, well, it helps the earth. But once the kids get up to 9, 10 years old, it's kind of nice if you know exactly why you're doing something, because I think that's even more motivation. I thought, well, this will be the easiest thing. I'm going to find a book. And I just couldn't find one for that age group that really, in a non-oversimplified way, explained why we recycle and why it's important to save energy and turn off your lights and not use so much stuff and whatnot. And So as kind of is my way, I decided, well, how hard would it be to write, you know, write a book, do some research and write a book for kids of this age? And so there was actually a first edition of it, which was a little bit more off the cuff. And then, as it turns out, through a series of people I knew, a wonderful publisher in New York, Skyhorse, was just starting a new imprint called Better World Kids. And this was actually their first title in that Better World Kids new imprint. I'm really proud of the book. It's a beautiful, colorful, you know, hardback book that I think, you know, most kids can hopefully get something out of.
Is that available like on standard websites, yeah. Amazon and all this?
It should be available pretty easily on Amazon. It's available on my website, yolandaharp.com. And actually, it was just picked up by Australian Scholastic and reprinted into paperback, which makes me really happy.
Wonderful.
Especially with what's going on in Australia right now, environmentally. I'm happy. I'm happy that kids are going to be able to get their hands on that cheaply and easily.
Well, and you put your money where your mouth is more often than not with this. I read that you give a proceed of all your royalties. A little bit of your royalties go to Earth causes.
Yeah, on specific projects, generally, I've tried to do that, especially projects that sort of fall in that category of the illuminating Earth awareness. I did an album a few years ago called Air, and that was music of Debussy and Takemitsu, and very sort of natural inspirations on that one. And then the Hovhaannes album, of course, trying to get as many projects going as I can in the very near future. I mean, this cause is really revving up for me right now. So I've got a lot of things in the works right now that hopefully will come to fruition in the next year or two.
In the forefront of everybody's discussion right now.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Now is the
perfect
time.
I think we've never been at a more pivotal moment for people to climb on this wagon. So, you know, whatever little way I can help with this foundation, Earth at Heart, and, you know, projects that I do, gosh, I feel compelled to do it.
Harpist Yolanda Condonassis is our guest today on Better Than Monkeys. I'm Brian Hanna, and Better Than Monkeys, it's a production of WQLN Radio. Orchestra work can be a little mentally exhausting. Traveling can be a little mentally exhausting. And I'm sure you don't listen to harp music 24/7. So I love orchestra music myself. I host a 4-hour daily classical music show. I play in lots of orchestras. But you know what I do in the evening? In the weekends, I play with a funk and R&B band. So I love...
Crazy.
I love R&B.
I
love soul. So obviously, I listen to a lot of that when I'm not actually at work. So, what's your go-to when you're not working? What's your go-to soundtrack?
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that kind of music because I have to admit there are times like when I'm working. My favorite thing to put on is I think my favorite sort of genre or category of music is string quartets. And I listen to that when I'm working because there are no words. It doesn't necessarily compete. I know the CDs so well that, you know, they're not competing for my attention.
Right.
And I have my guilty classical pleasures. But I would say when I'm just on long road trips, it is that R&B, that funk, I listen to pop, too. You know, I feel like pop music is like a timestamp. I like to, even if I don't love all of it, I have Sirius XM radio in my car, and I will definitely sometimes listen to Hits 1 just to know what's going on right now and who's big. And I like some of it, and I don't like some of it, but I think I can tell you exactly what was going on in my life based on, you know, the top 10 pop songs that were big at that time. But I would say if I can put anything on in my car that kind of on repeat loop, it's probably Bruno Mars. that gets a lot of play for me.
Well, again, it's probably a little bit like a string quartet. You know, you kind of get used to it. The rhythm gets you into a mood. You just follow it along. You can kind of lose yourself in it. You don't really have to pay close attention, but you can just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And you know, I really am one of those people. I grew up listening to an awful lot of stuff. I think when I was when I was young, Earth, Wind, and Fire was my, you know, I didn't drink coffee, actually, until I had my daughter, which is amazing, because now it's like, I think my blood level is at least 50% coffee on any given day. But you know, in years past, before that, my coffee was music, and I would, you know, rev up in the morning listening to, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Aerosmith, and you know, that was what got my heart started, you know.
So now that we know that you've got a little bit of rock and roll in your soul too, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about you're married to Michael Sacks, of course, the principal trumpet of the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. So the principal trumpet of an orchestra is a very alpha personality. They're the boss. They set the section rules. They set the course of how that whole brass section is going to play. You can't go into a principal trumpet role being feeble of character. So I would assume as a touring soloist, you're going to have very much the same kind of personality type. You've got to be brave and forthcoming and take charge, because you've got a very limited amount of time to present something in front of a whole lot of people who may never have seen you before. So the pressure of being a principal trumpet and being a touring soloist has to be very similar. So I would assume that you both have similar personality types. How does that work when you get home and you've just been touring and been the boss, and he's just been playing with the orchestra and been the boss? Who's the boss when you get home? You don't have to answer that.
We take turns. Yeah, well, we have one daughter, and she has a personality. She has, you know, rightfully so, a personality very much like both of us. So, it's funny, that unique chemistry. How does it work? You know, we've been married for 26 years, and
congratulations. That's very good.
Yeah, thank you. And we're both Sagittarians, which totally falls in line. I'm not a real, you know, horoscope watcher, but, you know, I do feel like usually when you read those descriptions of people and their astrological sign, you really see that, yeah, you know, that's their personality. And Sagittarians are generally exactly what you just described, very forthright, very motivated, very energetic, and, you know, that definitely fits both of us. I think there's a lot of give and take with us. Each of us kind of knows when to push the pedal and when to, you know, put on the brake.
Right.
In a family sense, and you know, we just, I think, respect each other a lot. I think that is at the heart of what we do, and I think that instead of kind of vying for alpha dominance, I think we just know how much pressure the other one is under, and we kind of know when to back off and when to support and when to just, you know, we you know, when Mike's doing a concerto with the orchestra, I don't always have this luxury, but I try to be home that week, and I just kind of clear the way.
Right.
And when he knows I got something big coming up, he does the same. He kind of takes care of the life details so that I can, you know, have a bit of a clear mind. So, you know, it takes work. Having a great marriage always takes work, but I think that this is, because we understand each other so well, this works certainly better than it might if we were not of a like mind. But, you know, it's we're each other's best friend, and I think that is
it's beautiful to hear these days.
Oh, yeah. And we've known each other, like, since we met at a music festival in Colorado in 1984. So, you know, he jokes that I knew him when he had a lot of hair. you know, just having that kind of history. And, you know, we basically both kind of came up in the world together. So, you know, we know each other's trials and tribulations. And we, you know, remember those conversations we had with each other from airports, and, you know, an audition that went well or one that didn't. And you know, we've been there for each other for a long time, and there's kind of no substitute
thing
for that.
You know, again, you know, you and Mike have been together for so long. Do you have the luxury of enjoying each other's performances very often, or is it really hard?
Well, that's a good question.
To bring that together?
I would say I get to hear him a lot more than he gets to hear me. I've played, I just this past year and a half has been I would say, dominated by the Jennifer Higdon Harp right. Concerto that I commissioned and premiered and recorded. And
it's nominated for a Grammy, from what I understand, too.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled.
Congratulations.
About that. Congratulations. Such a nice little perk at the end of the premiere series. It's really been great. But yeah, so that's kind of been the, I would say, if the last year and a half has had a theme, that's been it. And I've played it, I think, in a couple of weeks, it'll be my ninth weekend of performances of that. And Mike hasn't heard it live yet. So, and he can't then either. He's in Miami with the orchestra. So I think, one of these days he's going to hear me play this piece live. But I think.
Well, it's hard because his schedule is so fixed. You know,
I'm sorry?
His schedule is so fixed, you know, that
yes.
the Cleveland Orchestra schedule comes out and that's what the orchestra schedule is. You know, there's no variation.
Right. He has very little say in his schedule. And I would have to say that orchestras are planning later than they used to. When our daughter was small, we used to about three times a year, we'd spread out all our stuff on the kitchen table, our schedules, our printouts, our you know, everything, and figure out 3 or 4 months at a time how it was all going to work with childcare and that kind of thing. And we used to be able to plan a little more than we do now, because I used to have my schedule at least 2 years in advance, and he used to have his schedule a good year in advance. But there's a lot more fluidity now, you know, 15 years later than there was then, and we find ourselves with kind of sudden changes a lot more often. So, we make it work, though. I'm kind of proud that we never had a full-time nanny.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about your Grammy-nominated recording, which right now is in consideration as we speak for a Grammy Award. Now, this is your second nomination, so we're hoping you win something. This time that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, I don't want to become the Susan Lucci of the Grammy.
Yeah, the Susan Lucci of the harp Grammy. What was your first nomination?
It was for the album that I mentioned a while back, Air. It was for a piece by Takamitsu called "And Then I Knew 'Twas Wind." Wonderful, wonderful, evocative work. And that was in the chamber music category. But I'm thrilled this one is in the best classical solo instrumental category. Which
so
is,
has a
you
harpist
know, kind of a,
ever won
kind
that?
Kind of a nice category if you make your living
as a soloist. Has a harp soloist ever won that category? That you know
I do
of?
Not believe so. I do not believe so. So,
this could be big.
Yeah, it sure would be great for the harp, I think.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that album?
Well, this is the nomination is for specifically the Jennifer Higdon Harp Concerto. And it's from an album called American Rapture that was made just a little over a year ago with the Rochester Philharmonic and Ward Stair, wonderful conductor. He's just a fabulous person and a terrific musician. And he's a brass player as well. I don't know if you've crossed paths with Ward Stair, but he was principal trombone with the Lyric Opera in Chicago for quite some time. And the album kind of, you know, came into concept when sort of around the Jennifer Higdon Harp Concerto, because I talked with him very early on in the process when I was assembling the consortium, because, you know, whenever you commission a composer like Jennifer Higdon, you know, Pulitzer Prize winner, you know, just really wonderful, iconic voice, I think, of her generation, you definitely need a bunch of orchestras to collaborate and, you know, support the commission. And so Ward was one of the first people I talked with, and he was, you know, very excited and very on board. And so as the world premiere orchestra, I thought it would be really great if the Rochester Phil also recorded it. And they're a wonderful, you know, very sparkly orchestra. I love the way they sound. And we thought, that would make a great album to put the Jennifer Higdon on and sort of highlight three generations of American sound. So it includes Barber's First Symphony, and the Jennifer Higdon, sort of the middle generation, and then a work by a really wonderful young composer named Patrick Harlan called Rapture. And so that's kind of where we got the title of the album, American Rapture. It's three generations of American composers, and, you know, the music is so emotional, really, in all three cases that, you know, we thought that was a good way to tie it all together.
Well, it is a beautiful album. We have it here. Would it be okay if we could use a little bit of the Jennifer Higdon, just maybe 30 seconds to a minute on the podcast? That's up to you.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
Just enough to give everybody a little taste as we go out of the podcast. That'd be a great way to wrap it up. Maybe it'll encourage some people to take a listen to the album.
No, I think the more musical samples in life, the better.
Absolutely. I agree with you so much. So thank you so much for spending some time with us. We've kept you for a very long time. Yeah, you're very easy to talk to. You're a great interview. But why don't we give you just a couple seconds to go ahead and give yourself a few plugs. You can plug your book. You can plug any of your recordings. Anything you want to push. We know that that's a major part of marketing yourself as a soloist. So.
Oh, well, you know, I'm just really proud of this Jennifer Higdon Harp Concerto recording, and I think that, you know, given my mission in life to try and inspire as much idiomatic music for the instrument as possible, this book, just out by Carl Fisher, The Composer's Guide to Writing Well for the Modern Harp, I'm really hopeful that that will give composers a really user-friendly, you know, way to enhance their writing for the harp. So a lot of good stuff going on, and I so appreciate the podcast and can't wait to hear it.
Well, thank you very much, Yolanda. Have a great afternoon.
All right, same to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to let just a little bit of the fourth movement of Jennifer Higdon's Harp Concerto take us out of this episode of Better Than Monkeys. This performance, of course, featuring Yolanda Condonassis on harp with Ward Stair and the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Brian Hanna. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Better Than Monkeys. If you'd like more information on Yolanda Condonassis, well, you can find it at her website, yolandaharp.com. Again, I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN Radio. Thank you.